You're listening to an Iconic exclusive, which is an interview that we do with one of the industry designers or participators with 13th Age. Due to the nature of the interview, this podcast may run a little bit longer than our normal episodes, as we're just going to let the person we're interviewing talk and answer our questions, and we're going to have a good time doing it. So just be warned, this one may run longer than what you're normally used to listening to.
This is Iconic, with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick. Iconic exclusive.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hey.
How do?
And actually this week we have a special guest, Wade Rocket from Pellegrin Press. Welcome, Wade.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Fans of the podcast will know Wade from the 13th Age community. He is the community manager and the PR person, as well as Pellegrin Press other games. Kind of handle all of that. We have saved him from being fired on at least one occasion by showing up and purchasing 13th Age in volume. He's also a writer and editor who's worked on other Dungeons & Dragons magazines for Wizards of the Coast, Tales of the Old Margreave for Kobold Press, and the Emmy-nominated Midgard Bestiary for 13th Age. And Wade, you are also, as of this recording, editing Deep Magic, correct?
I am indeed. Deep Magic, the 13th Age compatible edition for Kobold Press.
Excellent. Well, we'll get into that a little later. Let's start off with kind of our standard question for you. How did you get into role-playing games?
You know, I keep hearing about these role-playing games, and I'm really excited to try one someday. They sound pretty neat. It's funny. I actually had to go to Wikipedia to find out what year I actually got into role-playing games, and it turned out it was 1980. I was in junior high, and a friend of mine bought AD&D, the fairly newly released Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, and invited me to play. And I know it was 1980 because that was when the Deities and Demigods first edition came out with the Cthulhu and Melniboné mythos.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I have it in my basement.
In my struggling 20s, I sold it for groceries and rent, and I finally recovered it recently. But that was it. And, of course, in 1980, I mean, Dungeons & Dragons was actually huge. It was a fad. And so it was very exciting to be in the hobby at that time. Through Dragon Magazine, I learned about games like Champions and Call of Cthulhu, and those actually became the go-to games for me and my friends for many years. After that, I went away to college in 1988 and left my gaming group behind and was out of the hobby for quite a long time. And I only got back into role-playing when 4th edition D&D came out, and a friend of mine invited me to join his group, and I thought, well, you know, this is kind of an event and would be a good occasion to get back into it on a regular basis, and so I did, and just the bug bit me once again.
So what prompted you to make this change from just playing role-playing games to actually helping design and create them?
Well, it started when I met Wolfgang and Shelley Bauer socially at NorwestCon. We were introduced by a mutual friend, and because I'd been out of the hobby for so long, I actually didn't know who Wolfgang Bauer was. I just thought that he was a really cool guy, which he is, that I was introduced to, and we started hanging out a bit, and I interviewed him for a podcast that I actually did at the time about freelance writing, where he told me that he had just started this company called Open Design based on the patronage model. And that he was going to launch a magazine soon called Kobold Quarterly. And I thought, oh, well, that's cool. And then later on, when I was talking to him about wanting to get into to do some freelancing, he said, well, I could use some help with marketing and copywriting. So if you want to do it for fun and some extra pocket money, I'd be happy to put you to work as a Kobold minion. And so that was really how I got into the industry, was just doing some stuff for Wolfgang and Kobold Press. My first credit where I was actually doing work inside the covers was for Tales of the Old Margreave anthology. I was a patron backing that project, and one of the things I submitted for consideration was a short story drawn from the world of Midgard. It was a fable about how a woodcutter met the moonlit king of the elves in the woods, and the designer Tim Connors liked it so much that he put it in as the first thing, the bit of introductory fiction in the book. which was incredibly exciting. It was even more exciting when I saw a Paizo thread of a GM talking about how he used the story in his campaign and how he read it aloud to his players, and it provided some story hooks. So that was absolutely wonderful. And so it kind of went from there. I did a little bit of editing for people who submitted things to Page XX for 13th Age. When Ash did the Midgard Bestiary, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit later, Wolfgang approached me to do some editing for that. And so, yeah, just as the opportunity has provided itself, I've gotten into design and editing and writing. But mainly, my role in the role-playing game industry is in PR and marketing, because that's actually my day job. I work for a PR agency, and I am the only PR person that most tabletop designers know or can tolerate. So that was kind of how that happened. I actually met Rob Hainso through a coworker, and he knew about my work with Wolfgang, and he said, well, we're launching this game. It's going to come out in playtest real soon, called 13th Age, and we could really use help with PR and marketing for it. Would you be willing to do that? And I said, work with Rob Hainso and Jonathan Tweet on a game? Hell yes.
Yeah. That's a no-brainer.
I know. It's like, if I don't say yes, then I'm going to kick myself for the rest of my life. So,
exactly.
Yes, I absolutely said yes. And then based on that, Simon Rogers said, well, we could use some help with other Pelgrane titles. Would you be willing to do that? And I said, well, I have absolutely no time, but yes, I will certainly do that. So that's really my incredibly roundabout path into the RPG industry. So when people say, how do you break into tabletop design? It's like, make friends with Wolfgang and be useful.
Helps to know the right people.
You know, it really does. And this is such a small industry that it's not hard to get to know the right people. Just show up and be decent and like I said, just be useful, and people will get to know you and trust you, and you can, if you send them something, then they're more likely to take a look at it because they know you.
So what upcoming industry product are you most excited about?
Something that I have been waiting for in suspense ever since I first heard about it is the annotated Dracula for Knights Black Agents with Pelgrane Press. And I believe that there is an accompanying volume. It's an adventure called The Dracula Dossier. And the idea is that the novel Dracula by Bram Stoker is a heavily fictionalized version of an actual thing that happened, where British intelligence tried to recruit Dracula to help them, and things went horribly, horribly wrong. And so the annotated Dracula is the Bram Stoker novel with margin notes by British intelligence agents across the decades saying, okay, here's what really happened in that scene. And that I just absolutely love that concept. And the Dracula Dossier is an actual campaign based on that, very much like the Armitage Files, where you can kind of start anywhere and progress in a really interesting way.
So it's like a Pride and Prejudice and Zombies for role-playing games.
Almost, yeah, yeah.
Excellent.
So I'm very, very excited to see that come up, and I hope we'll be hearing news of it soon.
Yeah, I think when we interviewed Gareth, I think he mentioned that he was looking forward to this product coming out as well. So we'll definitely have to keep our eye on that.
Yeah, definitely.
So in the midst of all your work, are you playing anything right now?
Yes, I am playing 13th Age, unsurprisingly.
Of course you are. So
yeah,
are we.
I started a campaign. I ran the playtest originally, and then several of the people who were at my table then joined me for an ongoing campaign. You can look it up on Obsidian Portal. It's called Black March, and it takes place kind of in the upper left corner of the Dragon Empire map, where I saw that there was a town called Foothold that is right on the edge of the territory of both the Diabolist and the Orc Lord, and I thought that is a fantastic place to put a campaign. So yeah, I've been running that, I don't even know, for maybe a year and a half. I try to run once a month, but life sometimes gets in the way, so it's fairly sporadic, but we have this ongoing arc that's been going on for quite a while.
Awesome. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, it was originally inspired. Actually, the idea predates 13th Age. I was thinking of running it for either basic D&D or for Lamentations of the Flame Princess, and it was going to be kind of a dark frontier campaign about demons and demonic influence and how you would show up in this creepy village where you weren't quite sure who was going to try to sacrifice you the next night, and people would disappear suddenly, And then 13th Age came out, and so I decided to run it there. The other influence on it was the Coen Brothers version of True Grit, which is a wonderful movie. And when they cross the river into Indian territory in pursuit of this fugitive, and they kind of enter this area, this wilderness, where they meet all these really strange, dangerous, desperate characters, I thought to myself, that's D&D.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is what I want, is you cross this river and suddenly you're in another world where you're likely to be killed and eaten.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to subscribe to that on Obsidian Portal and keep my eye on that. That sounds fascinating.
So do you do regular updates?
It updated, and I'm always trying to incorporate the latest and greatest thinking about GMing 13th Age, which is its own art altogether, into the campaign, particularly as regards something that a lot of people talk about, which is, of course, how to use icon rolls most effectively.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what's the predominant icons in that game, or in that setting?
The predominant icons, the bad guys are the Orc Lord and the Diabolist, and that really raised an interesting situation immediately, because one of the characters decided he wanted to be a double agent for both the Emperor and the Orc Lord. And he was a starry-eyed idealist who had this dream of uniting the two icons. And I'm like, no. Like, I don't want to say no, and I don't often say no. I'm all about yes. But in this case, it's like, no, the Orc Lord is really the bad guy in this whole campaign. And I'm not prepared to make him good, because it's just really central to my whole concept of what this campaign is all about, that the Orc Lord represents chaos and the destruction of civilization and just all the forces that are bubbling beneath the surface to bring down everything that is good and true. And I'm not prepared to go that far, but I am willing to explore this idea with you, what you want to do with orcs and the situation of orcs and half-orcs on the frontier. But eventually, just being a double agent for a good icon and a villainous icon proved too much, and he switched to a less complex gray area character. Those are the main bad guys. The Crusader is involved a bit. The Paladins of the Crusader are often swaggering around Foothold, and my take on them is that they're kind of like Blackwater mercenaries. They're just, guys with crew cuts and huge egos who like blowing people's heads off and high-fiving each other.
Me likey.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's how Mark There's plays his half-orc.
What's that?
That's how Mark plays his half-orc in my 13th Age game.
You should. Yeah. I think that is a great type in the 13th Age campaign. We have an elf who is an elf sorceress who is the subject of experiments by servants of the Archmage. We have a paladin of the Inquisition who serves the Emperor. So yeah, those are the main icons.
Very cool. So let me ask you this, because we're going to be doing, or we will, by the time this has come out, we will have already done our show on variant ways to use icon relationships. Mm-hmm. What's the most useful or most interesting way you use icon relationships at the table?
So I'll have people roll after a session or before a session, and then I will put a lot of thought into, okay, what does this mean, and how can I adjust the next adventure to accommodate that? So that's mainly how I've been using them, and it's kind of a very traditional way of using icon rolls, if you can say that there is such a thing. Lately, I've been trying to introduce other ways to use it at the table. When we culminated a big story arc in my campaign where the party went off to a lumber camp where demons had taken over and they fought the big bad guy for that particular arc, I gave them minions or red shirts, kind of, based on their icon roles. And so the ranger was able to go in with a posse of crusader paladins at his back. The cleric was able to say, okay, an hour before, a cleric who I made an appointment with discovered that I'd gone off into the woods to fight demons, and he has just shown up, and he just so happens to be a healer, and we are all at zero XP, so he starts running around healing people. It's like, okay, that happens. Somebody else said, oh, the sheriff back in town just realized that we've gone off into the woods without any backup, and so he sends a group of people out to help us fight these guys. And it's like, okay, they show up. And so they started spending those relationship points to get allies into the battle and help them. And I thought that was a really fun and interesting way to handle it.
So did you let them play those NPCs?
I did let them play the NPCs. I have way too much to do. although it was interesting, because one of the NPCs was fairly important. to the story and to the setting. He was a local dwarf merchant who is a pillar of the community, and so the guy I gave him to kept him out of the fight because he felt from a story perspective it would be worse if he died, whereas in a tactical, you know, from a tactical perspective, he would be a really useful resource in the fight. And so that was really interesting to see those wheels turn in his head. Because I kept saying, like, it's okay. If he dies, it'll be all right. I'll figure out a way to hand wave it. but no, I said, no. He had completely bought into everything I'd been setting up about this character, which is he's really important, and you guys have to walk carefully around accusing him of anything evil. And now that he's a good guy, they didn't want to let go of that, which I thought was really cool to see them buy in like that. A thing I've done lately, because I'm not getting a lot of player engagement with the icon roles yet, so I'm trying to find ways to get them to make decisions about the icon roles. So when one of my players got a 6 with a 3, I knew they were going to be fighting draconic enemies, and I said, okay, you can either get a +1 to hit all draconic foes for the rest of the adventure, or you can save it, and I will tell you something really insightful and not obvious about what's going on in this adventure. And so she had to make a choice between, again, something kind of story-driven and something tactical. I don't know. I'm always looking for new ways to use it, because it's a really interesting kind of tech, and I think that it's very much in its raw form at this point, and people are going to be doing really interesting things to bring it to the table. How about you?
Well, in our 13th Age game, I've been trying to shift the focus from me deciding what icon results are to my players as well. We're playing through Eyes of the Stone Thief right now, and so the main thing I would say that they use them for is for insight into Gareth's riddles, which have really brutal consequences if you don't solve. So they've been like, well, what can the 3 tell me about this? What does the Archmage know about something like this?
That's cool.
I think I'm in the process of making the transition. So I would say right now about 60% of the time I'm like, hey, you could use your icon role to get this kind of a benefit or learn something about this. And I would say, I know Mark has, and I think Luke, one of my other players, has started to say, well, you know, I rolled this with the Crusader. I should know about this, or I should be able to do something like this. So I'm kind of in that transition phase.
Of course, it's like, no, the Crusader knows nothing about this.
Well, you know, undead spiders really aren't his realm. Demons, he knows a lot about it.
Ah, well, you're forgetting about the war between the Spider Kingdom and the Demon Princes back in the 4th Age.
Oh, see? I totally forgot about that war, Mark.
Yeah.
Thanks, Wade. I will bring that up.
Thanks. He's totally giving me that look like, well, now I want to play in Wade's game.
It's funny because that's the kind of thing that I'll bust out on the spur of the moment, but then my players will ask for more details. It's like, I just made that up. I really don't know anything else about that war. Give me a little bit to work on that, and I'll get back to you.
Well, that's a good point. I should let my players know that if they can justify it with something that happened in a previous age, I'm already getting a lot, some flack, I would say, from some of my players who feel like I'm a little too lenient when backgrounds apply. The joke is that in our Shadowrun game, my wife had martial arts, and she was rolling it for everything. And so people are now in 13th Age like, well, I have martial artist as a background. I know how to interpret dwarven runes. I'm like, okay, not that far. I tend to be a little bit more lenient with how backgrounds are interpreted right now.
Yeah, I am too, frankly. If you can just give me something plausible and entertaining, then I will most of the time let you do it, and it doesn't really break things.
I like the say-yes mentality of GMing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I mean, it was interesting because I came to the table in our first character creation session with this idea that I just told you about this frontier campaign that's kind of creepy and haunted, and then people made characters, and that was one of those eye-opening instances where you really see the power of the system come to life, because their choices with one unique things and backgrounds fleshed out the world that I was establishing to an incredible degree. I had no idea that the Archmage had servants who were performing secret magical experiments on elves. And so suddenly I had this conspiracy that was chasing after this character, and I had to figure out, okay, well, why are they doing that? And why did they choose her and why are they after her? What mm-hmm. What do they want from this? The paladin who said that he wanted to be an inquisitor, I said, an inquisitor for whom? And we bounced some ideas around, and he settled on the emperor. And so I went and researched the Inquisition, the historical Inquisition, and then applied it to the Dragon Empire and said, okay, what's their role? How are they funded? What are their activities? What can they do and can't they do? What relationship do they have to law enforcement? But until that moment, I didn't know that the emperor had an Inquisition. So, yes, it's just really great when players can bring that and add to the world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely one thing that, as a player, I really appreciate about 13th Age is that player agency, mm-hmm. where they can negotiate with the GM and say, well, how about we spin it this way and see what happens?
Yeah, funny thing. When the party went into that big lumber camp adventure, the climactic battle that I was telling you about, I had the elf sorceress, who was the subject of magical experiments, start making saving throws whenever they encountered demonic activity. And after she failed a certain number, suddenly she turned into evil version of the elf sorceress and was much more powerful and competent. And she had to make that choice, because if she didn't, she could make a save to break that kind of possession that she was undergoing. If she didn't, then she would start attacking the characters once all of her enemies were dead. But as long as she was evil version of herself, she was really powerful and was doing a great job of clearing the deck of bad guys. So she kind of had to wrestle with herself. It's like, how much do I want to unleash this demon part of myself, because I'm really effective at combat right now?
I'm noticing a theme in your games of balancing that tactical side of things versus the story side. I think you've mentioned that a couple times, and it's really coming out. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and it's something that just kind of evolved. I do like giving people hard choices to make. Those are the really interesting things at the table, and Rob Hainso is really good at that. When I played with him during a demo session at PAX once, just because he needed to fill the table, he was very good at those kinds of Faustian bargains, saying, I can give you this advantage at this cost, and often it was a tactical advantage at a story cost. But it could go the other way, and I thought that was a much more interesting way to play things at the table and make things entertaining for people than just throwing numbers at them. Just like, here's this array of monsters, or here's this trap, mm-hmm. or whatever. It's like you have to make a difficult choice that will affect yourself and other people.
That's good. I play NGM, and from my perspective, I think it's really rewarding when your players go with the storyline more than the plus two bonus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm all for the plus two bonus also, but especially because some of my players seem to be dice cursed.
Every group has that.
Yeah, that's another thing that is a GM talent that I would really like to acquire better, is if people are just rolling poorly the whole time, what can you do to keep them from being demoralized?
Serve snacks.
There you go. It's just delicious snacks. That's the solution.
That's right. I find myself more, this like last night, we have a number of half-orcs in the group, and they were rolling bad, and I was reminding them of their half-orc racial ability each battle, because I was just like, I feel bad for you. Don't forget, you can re-roll one attack roll.
Don't forget you're a half-orc.
That's right. Don't forget that you are a half-orc. Well, here, let me ask you a question about Midgard. So you worked on the Midgard bestiary with Ashlaw, the 13th Age conversion. What is Midgard? And why was there a 13th Age bestiary for it?
Midgard is the campaign setting for most of Kobold Press products, certainly its adventures, and it's also kind of found its way into various other supplements. It originally began actually in Wolfgang Bauer's high school D&D campaign with notes. He has, I think, some of the original notes in his notebook from back then. And so when he started open design and designing adventures, he would set things in the free city of Zobek. And more people demanded to know, well, what's over the next hill from Zobek? If I go north or west, what am I going to find there? And he'd say, well, you find the dwarven cantons off to the north, and there's this undead kingdom off. I'm actually doing a little bit of a Wolfgang impression. there's an undead kingdom off there ruled by vampires, and there's ghouls underneath. There's an empire of the ghouls below the earth. so finally, he just kind of gave in because he really wanted to keep it open-ended, which is, I think, is an interesting parallel with Rob and Jonathan's take on the Dragon Empire. He wanted people to just make their own world and put Zobek in it, and he would provide things to kind of fill out your own homebrew campaign. But eventually, popular demand was, you know, we want a Midgard campaign setting, and so he launched a Kickstarter, and he put out this book, The Midgard Campaign Setting, which is pretty much system neutral, although when there is crunch, it's for Pathfinder.
Okay.
It's a great world. It is very heavily influenced by Central and Eastern European folklore and history and mythology, which I like a lot, rather than the kind of standard generic sort of Northwest European-ish settings or the kitchen sink settings you'll sometimes see. So it's kind of dark. There's a lot of wild, powerful magic in the world, and this kind of sense of weirdness and doom that permeates it, and it is a tremendous amount of fun. As to why 13th Age, well, in part because I'm on the Cobalt team, and I was playing 13th Age and doing PR for 13th Age, and I'm like, hey, Wolfgang, you should really check out this cool game 13th Age, and maybe we can do some stuff for it. And he was willing to consider it, but at that point it was still a fledgling game, and so he kind of was taking a wait-and-see approach before really investing in it. Enter Ash Law, who is a wonderful, enthusiastic, and very persuasive human being. And at the launch party for, I think, the Midgard campaign setting, he said to Wolfgang, hey, you know, you should do a conversion of your Midgard bestiary for 13th Age. And Wolfgang said, who would design it? And Ash said, I would. So... And so he did, and then Wolfgang said, hey, who could edit this? And I said, honestly, given the number of people familiar with the system at this point who are also familiar with Midgard, I think the answer is me. I'm the only person who knows both Midgard and 13th Age, and he said, I was hoping you'd say that. You're the editor. And so that was how we came up with the Midgard bestiary for 13th Age, which is now nominated for an Ennie.
Yes.
It's incredible.
What can you tell us? Can you give us a little insight into what's in the book? What your favorite monster is out of there?
Oh, gosh. The Midgard Bestiary has lots and lots of monsters. In fact, you know, maybe I should open this up on my computer while I'm talking to you.
I was hoping my copy would be in by today, but unfortunately my local game store won't get it until tomorrow. So.
Oh, no, and you don't have it on a PDF?
I do not.
Well, that's okay. I'll just read it to you if that's okay. I think that'd be really entertaining also for the listener.
The next 12 hours will be Wade reading the bestiary to us.
And I'll be doing it in the voice of George Takei, if that's okay.
Perfect.
So the Midgard bestiary contains something like 100 or 101 monsters converted more or less from the Midgard bestiary for 4th edition D&D, which is also a great book, but Ash has done a magnificent job of kind of stripping the monsters down to their essentials and saying, okay, what makes this cool, and how do we bring that to life in 13th Age? So you will find, again, those kind of like Eastern European, Central European kind of folklorish monsters. You'll find a lot of clockwork creatures. You'll find diabolical gnomes who have made deals with the devils of the Nine Hells to protect them from Baba Yaga. Ghouls and ghasts. It's also kind of nice because a lot of people have wanted the PC races as foes. They say, "How do I set up a fight with elves? How do I fight up a self? Set up a fight with dwarves?" And so, dwarves and elves are both in here. We also did 9 player character races: centaurs, ghouls, gearforged, gnolls, several types of goblins, kobolds, of course. And I wrote up a section on icons that you can use in a campaign set in Midgard. My favorite creature from that, it's difficult to choose because there are so very many of them. I have always been attracted to the elves of the Arbaness in this. In the world of Midgard, elves are very rare. They used to rule the entire world, and everyone else bent the knee to them. And then various sorts of setbacks and misfortunes drove them out of the world, and they went off somewhere else, and there's a small remnant left in the Arbaness Forest, and they're very kind of cold and haughty and consider everyone beneath them. And so playing with that, to me, I really love that take on elves, and so I really like the Arbaness Exiles in the book.
Isn't that how all the elves are?
That's how I run them.
I think they should be.
So what's your favorite?
Either that, or they should either be cold and haughty and elitist, or they should be little people with pointy hats and pointy ears who dance about.
That's a really interesting concept of having those player character races in a bestiary. Did you have a hard time balancing the stats as a foe versus the racial stats as for a player?
Not really. I mean, part of it, I think, is that we can just say, oh, well, these are the dwarves of Midgard, or these are the elves of Midgard, and so they're kind of their own thing. It really wasn't intended as a straight-across conversion of, oh, well, this is a high elf, and so therefore in a high elf statted up for as a monster is going to look like this. I've done a little bit of that in my own home campaign. They ended up fighting dwarves a lot because tensions between the humans and dwarves are kind of high in Foothold. But it hasn't really been a big deal. Mainly, it's just, I mean, the monster creation in 13th Age is such a wonderful toolkit because you have that do-it-yourself monster section where you can pretty easily make foes that are appropriate to a certain level. And then the idea of having these powers that are triggered by the dice rolls or other conditions in battle really kind of let you sculpt a monster that is really, that captures the essence of whatever it is. And so, you know, the Arbaness Emissary or the Exiled Theurge or something like that is going to behave kind of according to your mental image of what that kind of thing is. Let's see, the Arbaness Exiled Mage, which has, which unleashes thunder and lightning on its foes and ball lightning, and then has a Fae Grace power, which lets it sort of glide through the terrain, which is something we kind of leave up to the group. And that's one of the things with monster design that I'm finding is, especially because Kobold Press is so heavily invested in Pathfinder and so many of its products are for Pathfinder, and I have designed a book for Pathfinder, the Ravenfolk Advanced Races book for Kobold Press, and it is a very fiddly system. Mm-hmm. And if there was anything that I didn't nail down precisely, the editor would come back and with a million questions about the implications, because you know players at the table are going to find the loophole for that, and so you have to be super specific. With 13th Age, the challenge is striking that balance between telling somebody exactly what happens when you do this versus giving each table the freedom to figure out what they want to happen when you do this and not be too constrained by the rules. Mm-hmm. And so if you say that Elves of the Arbaness have something called Fae Grace that lets them pass over difficult terrain as if it were normal terrain, well, we don't really have terrain rules in 13th Age, right? So if that could just be a special effect, you know, to something that mm-hmm. the GM relates and says the elves seem to move with an unnatural grace as if they are not of this world, or if it actually has some sort of impact in combat that they have some advantage over the characters if they are fighting in some place that's difficult to navigate. And, you know, we're going to leave that up to you guys.
Cool. So what's your favorite icon from Midgard?
My favorite icon, it switches back and forth a bit. My first love was Nikephoros the Pale, the Emperor of the Ghouls, because I just love the idea of a subterranean empire of the ghouls so very, very much. When Wolfgang told me about it and about the concept and when I read about them in the Midgard supplements, it was just like, yeah, of course these guys should absolutely rule the Underdark. I mean, ghouls are amazing. They are powerful. They are deathless. They can march forever. And the only thing that's keeping them from consuming everything is the fact that they can't go out on the sun. As soon as the Emperor figures out a way around that, then we're all going to be lunch. I'm a big fan of that feeling of doom.
A really big umbrella.
Yeah.
Sunblock.
Worked in Blade.
Lately, though, the more I think about it and just the kinds of games that I like to run, I think it would be a lot of fun to play with Baba Yaga as an icon.
Mm.
She is a very complex and ambiguous character. She is dangerous and deadly, but she can also be an ally. She's just pursuing her own agenda, and you never really know what it is. And so that just gives you a lot of flexibility to make interesting deals with players and have events kind of fall into place around the world and say, oh, okay, guess who actually benefits from this? Hey, it's Baba Yaga. So I think she'd be a really fun icon to run.
Well, so continuing in the vein of Cobalt Press products, Deep Magic yes. is coming out, and it is coming out for Pathfinder and 13th Age.
It is out for Pathfinder.
Oh, it is out already for Pathfinder. When yes. can we expect it out for 13th Age?
Yeah. Well, first I have to finish editing it. No pressure. My deadline is August 1st,
okay.
and it is 209 pages, something like, 100,000 words, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, but again, it was not only do I think I could do a good job with this, but it's just such a great opportunity to really make this kind of contribution to the game. I know that more spells are things that's something that I've really wanted for 13th Age, and I think that a lot of people will have fun with. And it's just a pleasure to kind of discover what crazy thing Ash has done. He has this just wild creativity and this sense of fun and whimsy. I'm going through it and finding all sorts of interesting things. And again, that there's that balance where you're dealing with a conversion of a book of spells for Pathfinder where you have to be super specific. And even though you might come up with all sorts of great ideas for how somebody might use a spell like Dome of Silence or Douse Light, and I keep thinking of how players might want to use this. It's like if you have a spell that puts out one small natural source of light that you can see, I have it here in front of me, such as a candle, lantern, or torch, my first thought was, okay, you know what else is a small natural source of light? A firefly. Can Douse Light put out a firefly? And it's like, and somebody might say, well, why on earth would a player want to douse a firefly? It's like, somebody will want to douse a firefly.
Just because
they
can.
So how do you do that? Yes, just because you can. How cool would it be to just wave your hand and all the fireflies go out? That would be like a pretty badass move in the right circumstances. So I had to think, all right, how mechanically does that happen, or do I just leave that to the poor GM to rule however they want? So, yeah, all this in answer to your question, when's it going to be out? So, yes, my deadline is August 1st for editing, and we are looking to get it out, knock on wood, by the end of the year.
Awesome.
I mean, there's so much. I've learned with 13th Age that printing and shipping are fraught with peril, and so you can't really commit too hard to a date because things go wrong and there's nothing you can do about it because it's at a printer hundreds or thousands of miles away, and you just have to, you know, they have to resolve the problem and get the books out. But that's what we're shooting for.
Excellent.
So in the vein of talking about what's in the book, what can you tell us about any schools of magic or maybe a sneak peek at what your favorite spell is or something like that?
Schools of magic. The first thing I'm going to tell you, actually, before I get to the schools of magic, is that there are two new talents, which are actually, it's actually one talent that we're probably going to break up into two. It's called Specialty Caster, and this is a mechanic that lets any class, whether they're a caster or a non-caster, cast wizard spells by replacing a class talent with the Specialty Caster talent. And Ash has been using this in his home campaign, and every character now has at least a little bit of wizard magic, and apparently it's doing really interesting things to the game, interesting and good things to the game. So I'm really excited to see how people are going to be using that, or people who decide no, that they don't want rangers to be able to cast spells, because I know that the balance between the kind of grittier, more martial focused campaign versus the high magic campaigns, people have very different preferences. So that's the first thing, is we're introducing a couple of new talents. As to my favorite schools of magic, so I'll tell you about a couple here. So there's the Arbaness Academy, which was actually passed down by Arbaness exiles who are teaching these secrets of elven magic, particularly to do with magic that affects bows and bow fighting. And so each class will have a short description and then a list of spells that are associated with that school. So, for example, the Arbaness Academy has Arrow of the Animal Spirit, Avenge the Pain, Ice Arrow, Point the Way, Slice the Air, and Weapon of Blood. The Children of the Stones are actually pacifists, and so their spells are going to be more a little more defensive, Natural Horror, Pollen Cloud, Shrieking Flock, Speak with Ancestors. There is a cult of Ouroboros that worships serpents, which I quite like a lot because they're fairly sinister, and yet this is a school of magic that's being presented to player characters. It says their eventual goal is to achieve apotheosis and transform themselves into mighty serpents, a dream that their Naga masters encourage. And as is often something that Ash does, whenever he introduces something, he likes to add equipment to it, introduce gear. And so if you're a member of that cult, then you start out with a wavy dagger, a snake tattoo, and a snakeskin robe. And if you have left the cult, then here's what else you get. You know, so whenever possible, we like to give people gear or magic items or something like that that go with a school or, I mean, and you'll see this throughout the Midgard bestiary also. Like, we tried to provide magic items associated with every kind of monster, as well as things that you'll find on that monster and adventure hooks associated with it. So there's a little bit of that in here as well. One thing that I kind of like, though, is there's a school of magic called the Doom Tollers, and they are a group of witches who operate as a protection racket.
So the witch mafia?
Kind of, yeah.
So when a player takes one of these talents, does it tie to the school? How will schools interact with the existing classes for 13th Age?
A school is just kind of a way to... And again, since I'm so deep in editing it, I haven't figured out how to talk about it to other people yet. But basically, it's just kind of a way of making a more flavorful character by saying, okay, my spell list consists of these spells because those are the spells taught by my school. And so, because if you're doing something for Pathfinder, of course, you'll say, well, you know, this is a spell from the school of necromancy.
Right.
Like, well, you don't really have those kinds of schools in 13th Age, so what other function could the concept of a magical school or magical tradition serve? And as with so many questions, the answer to that is, well, it makes a character more awesome. And so they could be, you know, they could have the spells they do because they are a member of the Hammer of Valhalla school, which sounds just incredibly cool. And so it's mostly an organizational structure for casters.
Okay.
So as the White Dragon is our mascot, how would you answer the following question for your 13th Age game? Who was White and why did the Lich King kill him?
Now, just so you know, Gareth's interview has not gone live at this point, but it will have by the time yours goes live, and his answer was fantastic, so...
The pressure's on.
The pressure's on.
I am competing with a very intelligent and creative and charming British fella.
Who was talking at 5 in the morning, so he was pretty tired.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. All right, so for my campaign, who is the White and why did the Lich King kill him? The White was actually killed, according to the book, by the Wizard King before he became the Lich King, if I remember correctly.
That is correct.
So in my campaign, I'm going to say that the White is sort of a tragic anti-hero, almost like a Severus Snape or even a Darth Vader, that he is a dragon who's kind of on the dodgy side of things, maybe sometimes evil and not very well trusted by people, but the Great Gold Worm saw the potential for true heroism in the White. And when the forces of civilization and good were uniting to overthrow the Wizard King, he persuaded the White to take on the power that could destroy the Wizard King if he could insinuate himself close enough to him to do so. And so he managed to get one-on-one with the Wizard King, and then this kind of underestimated, ignored, kind of despised dragon unleashed this mighty power that almost completely destroyed the Wizard King, but not quite. And so in a rage, the Wizard King unleashed his power on the White and killed him and then raised him again as his undead servant by way of vengeance for the terrible offense that he'd done to him by almost killing him. Now, this means that if the characters encounter the White, which they certainly will if they are facing the Lich King as a villainous icon in the campaign, that there is perhaps a glimmer of goodness within him that they can appeal to and perhaps turn him against his evil master.
That's fantastic.
Thank you.
I think you gave Gareth a run for his money.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, good. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Gareth came up with.
We shall call it a tie.
Very diplomatic.
Well, Wade, thank you so much for coming on. Guys, do you have any other final closing questions for Wade? Wade, any questions for us?
Oh, gosh. No, I just want to say that I really enjoy this podcast, and it's just so wonderful that you guys put this out there. Having a fan podcast is just the best, and you guys are doing a great job, and so thank you so much for doing it.
Well, Mark did just show me a note. Is there any chance we'll get you to do the Owlbear song on the show?
Oh, gosh. I'll do my best. And I apologize if I get the words wrong, because it's been a while since I've done the Owlbear song. I'm a hungry owlbear, tall and sleek. Here are my claws, and here is my beak. Oh, gosh, I've already forgotten it. I've disappointed everyone.
We are pleased to announce our first contest for the Iconic Podcast. As you know, the White Dragon is our mascot, and so we're asking you, our listeners, to submit the answer to the following question. Who was the White Dragon, and why did the Wizard King kill him?
When you submit your entries, the things that we are looking for are creativity and entertainment. We will look at all of the submissions and evaluate them, and whichever one we like best or think that we could spin the best campaign off of, we will choose that as the winner. So, Wade, why don't you go ahead and tell us what the winners get?
Well, what could be better than a Pelgrane store voucher in a beautiful PDF format? So we'll be giving away three Pelgrane store vouchers, good for purchase of any product on the Pelgrane Press shop online, in the amounts of $20 for the grand prize, $10, and $5.
This contest ends October 31st, so make sure we have your email submissions to whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com before then.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.